This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
Rabble.ca.
Hi, I'm Wayne McPhail, and I was one of the people that originally started the Rabble Podcast Network, and I think that you should support the Rabble Podcast Network and Rabble.ca because there's no other place where you're going to get such a diversity of voices speaking truth to power.
The Rabble Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Show your support by going to rabble.ca/donate.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
Last Friday, an employment tribunal in the UK ruled that the transportation app Uber has to pay its drivers a national living wage and give them holiday pay. The ruling involves a case taken by two drivers, James Farah and Yasin Aslam, on behalf of a group of 19 Uber workers who argued that they were employed by the San Francisco-based firm rather than working for themselves. The ruling was hailed as a victory by GMB, Britain's general union, who said it would have an impact on thousands of workers in other industries where, they say, bogus self-employment is rife. Tom Slee is author of What's Yours is Mine Against the Sharing Economy. We spoke with Tom Slee back in April, and we're delighted to welcome him back to comment on this ruling. He joins me today from Montreal. Hello, Tom.
Hello, Jane, and thanks for having me back on the show.
Now, I have heard it called a landmark ruling. At least that's what the British press have been calling it. How significant do you think it is?
Well, I think it remains to be seen, but I do think it is very significant, partly because of the tone in which the ruling was set out. This may apply to 30,000 Uber drivers, so it's a lot of people. It's not only Uber that it may affect. There are delivery companies and so on who may also, where the people doing the delivery, the couriers, may also benefit from this. But of course, Uber is going to appeal it. So, you know, who knows quite where this will end up.
And I understand that Uber has so far said that it only applies to those two drivers who brought the case.
Yeah, well, that's not surprising, is it, in a way? And I think this is Uber. Uber, let's face it, has been the subject of a lot of law cases. There were 50 last year in the U.S. alone. So, you know, this is unusual because it's outside the U.S. So this is part of a regular flow of things where Uber's business model is being challenged, and increasingly, I think, successfully.
You mentioned the tone of the ruling. Talk to me a little bit more about that.
Well, part of Uber's case is that it doesn't employ the drivers. That really, you know, is it a technology company that just basically has an app, or is it a driving company? You know, is it a transportation company? And so the Judge Snelson from this employment tribunal wrote basically any organization running an enterprise at the heart of which is the function of carrying people in motor cars from where they are to where they want to be, requiring drivers and passengers to agree as a matter of contract that it does not provide transportation services, merits a degree of skepticism. And obviously, I think that's true. He goes on to quote Hamlet, you know, "We cannot help being reminded of Queen Gertrude's most celebrated line, 'The lady doth protest too much, methinks.'" And I think that makes sense. Does Uber provide transportation? You know, of course it does.
What test for employment did the judges use in making their decision?
Well, on Uber's side, the fundamental case that it has always made is that, you know, drivers are free to decide if and when they will work, right? You know, just because you sign up with Uber, it doesn't mean you have to log on at any particular time. So that's been their test. But there's a lot more than that to being an employee. And there are practices, you know, back through history, things like hiring halls where people will turn up if they feel like it, but they're still employees. So the judge looked beyond that and said, well, who sets the terms? Well, obviously Uber sets the terms of the ride. It tells the drivers who they're going to take. It tells them where they're going to take them to. It tells them what route they're going to go by. Uber can remove them from the platform if it feels like. Uber sets the prices. You know, all of these things. Uber determines how much commission it will take, so effectively what rate the drivers will get. Whether or not you're an employee is a matter of sort of looking over all of these aspects of your work.
Well, I believe one of the drivers said that he felt under tremendous pressure to take rides.
Well, yeah, and it's pressure. It's not just, you know, being nagged by the phone and by the app. I mean, you also can be removed from the platform if you refuse too many rides. So, you know, it's partly a contractual thing. You want to stay on this platform, you want to continue making money, here's how you behave. So I think, yeah, Uber puts people under a lot of pressure. I think the other thing is, you know, obviously, just over two years ago, Uber said that its drivers were making large amounts of money, and they quoted a figure of $90,000 in New York City. You know, since then, things have changed rapidly. And so these drivers, one said that, you know, that the minimum wage in London is £6.70 an hour, and he said that, you know, he tracked his work, and after expenses, he was earning £5 an hour. It's because Uber has become a low-pay environment that people start to really care. If you're earning $90,000 a year, you don't care how people classify you. But when you're down around minimum wage, you really care.
Has the amount of money that Uber drivers make changed?
Oh, it's changed dramatically. Uber has push down fares in order to get customers, to get riders. It takes a bigger share of the ride for itself, and it's continuing to find new ways to do this. They are pushing people to take up the Uber pool option in many cities, which is where you multiple people share a ride, and on that service, Uber takes a much bigger part of the fare than the driver. So this has changed dramatically. And I think it's important to recognize that with all this stuff, Uber is not yet a profitable company. So it's not even a sustainable business. They have $8 billion to spend of venture capital investment. But from what we know, they lost over $1 billion last year. So, you know, even at this stage, even at these low paying jobs, Uber still seems to have not found a way to make money out of this business.
Can you take that apart for me a little bit? Because I read that somebody said they're not making a profit, yet they're worth an enormous amount.
They are worth an enormous amount, yes. I mean, the market valuation, they're not a publicly traded company, but still when they invite investors, they do so at an estimated valuation. And their market valuation is, you know, depending on what you read, somewhere around $70 billion, 70, 80, 65, somewhere in that ballpark. And that puts them up at about the level of the biggest car companies, of Ford, of General Motors. So now it is an incredibly valuable company. And what this is that the investors are betting, first, that Uber can own this business globally, and secondly, that they can be profitable globally, that they can basically run as a monopoly, that they can set prices in order to return all that money to investors. So that's the bet that's being taken. But so far, you know, it doesn't look like a very good bet.
So that's the pressure then on Uber to continually cut rates that they pay drivers, is so that they can fulfill that promise that all their investors are hoping will come through. Is that?
Yeah. And they know that one of their biggest costs is drivers, and so, you know, they're taking some of this money and investing a lot of it in driverless car technology. You know, hoping that, you know, well, you know, if UberX doesn't do it, then maybe Uber Pool will make them profitable, and if that doesn't make them profitable, well, maybe down the line it'll be driverless cars. So it's sort of a bait and switch going on as they move from one business model to another, stringing people along to keep their money in the game till maybe the next one will pay out.
Were you encouraged by the ruling when you heard about it?
Tremendously, yeah. I think it's one of those things where Uber has been very effective at saying, look, we are a technology company, you know, we represent the future. And you've got a choice. Going around to cities and putting a lot of its really significant investment money behind this and delivering the message, look, we've got a popular thing here, and of course many customers like the Uber experience. You know, we've got a popular thing. You've got a choice. Get on this train now, or you're left behind. And I think increasingly cities are finding that, you know what, we don't have to just take what Uber says at face value. We can actually demand that they, you know, behave decently. We can push back a bit, and we can assert that we have rights. And I think, for example, Vancouver is doing exactly the right thing and saying, you know, we're not going to be hurried about this. You know, if it's now or in 12 months, you know, that's not actually a big deal.
Well, it's interesting what you say about it being very popular, because when I was reading about the ruling, the Guardian newspaper said, yes, good thing, but there were just the most outrageous articles in other newspapers saying, well, I like Uber. It's very convenient.
Yeah, and of course there are many people who like Uber, but again, I think we have to recognize that, first, the service is not what it was 2 years ago, and it's not what it's going to be in 2 years' time. And what you're getting is a subsidized ride, where Uber, I mean, partly because of rulings like this, Uber, it's subsidized by Uber, even though it doesn't have the expenses of, you know, of running employees. It doesn't have expenses of insurance. We know it doesn't pay taxes on the money it earns in cities around the world. So despite all those benefits, you know, it still can't make money. But of course those things cut down the cost to consumers. So in a sense, you know, it's price gouging. Everyone loves a deal. Is it too good to be true? Yes, it is.
Well, subsidized by Uber, and then, of course, obviously subsidized by the drivers, too.
Yes, subsidized by Uber, subsidized by the drivers, and in a sense, subsidized by the rest of us when they do things like, you know, if you get an Uber, if I take an Uber ride in Toronto, that transaction takes place in the Netherlands so that Uber can avoid paying taxes on it, you know. So subsidized by all of us because Uber doesn't want to pay taxes and contribute, you know, to what is needed to build the infrastructure that it runs on.
Well, it'll be interesting to see where this goes. And you mentioned there's a case being brought forward by bicycle couriers in the UK and another by a car courier firm.
Yes. So there's bicycle couriers for a company called Deliveroo, which, you know, runs, you know, restaurant pickups and so on. There is a similar company in the U.S. called Instacart, which does deliveries, and its drivers and cyclists and delivery people are also pushing back heavily. As money tightens up in the space, a lot of these companies are finding that, you know, it's not clear that this is necessarily a profitable model, and that to the extent it is, it's being done by, you know, running the employees, and I will say the word employees, into the ground.
Been good to talk to you this morning, Tom. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Jane.
I've been speaking with Tom Slee about the UK Employment Tribunal ruling that found Uber drivers were employees. Tom Slee is author of What's Yours Is Mine, Against the Sharing Economy.